So thank you everybody for coming. We're going to get started. Just a couple quick announcements first. The washrooms are through that back door and take a left, and then there's signs. If you're expecting anyone who is coming who uses a wheelchair, Griffin is the person that knows how to help folks, so just grab Griffin and let them know. Also, there's video and photography happening here this evening. If you're not comfortable being photographed or videotaped, if you can sit on the tables, we're promised by anyone taking photos or video that the tables won't be photographed or videotaped. And if you are asking a question and don't want to be photographed or videotaped, just say in advance and people will turn it off. My name is AJ Withers and I'm the MC for this evening. I'm a member of the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty. And we've come here today because our communities are under attack. Poor people in this city, and particularly in this neighborhood, are under attack. We've seen the closing of shelter beds, the loss of tens of thousands of meals a year, and the drive to push poor people out of the downtown core through anti-homeless bylaws, the Safe Streets Act, streets to homes, and skyrocketing rents. In addition to that, social assistance is shamefully and painfully low. People on welfare have the spending power of 1989 levels. And everyone on assistance needs a 40% increase in the rates immediately in order to live with dignity, to be able to pay for food and rent. Right now, a single person on welfare gets a shamefully low $364 a month for rent. A single person on ODSP or disability gets $464 for rent. Yet, a one-bedroom in this city, the average price of it is $927 a month. No matter how you do the math, social assistance rates never add up. Many people on social assistance, as I'm sure a lot of people in this room know, have been able to access extra money to be able to buy food through a benefit called the special diet. This is money that can be up to $250 extra on someone's check a month. This money has meant the difference between homelessness and housing, between hunger and food, and for many people, between sickness and health. In Toronto in 2002, the amount that was being spent on the special diet in this city was $2 million. Last year, it was about $55 million. That's $53 million more that was going directly into the pockets of poor people on social assistance in this city. Money for people to buy food. And that is thanks in large part to the organizing efforts of individuals on social assistance and the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty. In response to poor people getting enough to eat, and in response to the economic crisis, a crisis that has disproportionately impacted poor people, McGuinty's Liberals have targeted us, and in particular, they've targeted the money that we use to buy healthy food. Yesterday's budget saw a pathetic increase of social assistance rates, a raise of 1%. It's shameful and it's pathetic, and it doesn't even keep in line with inflation. At the same time, the province announced that it is killing the special diet program. This program will be eliminated in several months. We're going to do questions at the end. And this amounts to an overall cut of the entire system about 1.5%. But to someone on welfare who's getting the full amount, it's a 30% loss of income. And for someone on ODSP, it's a 19% loss of income. This cut will devastate us. It'll devastate our families and our communities. And this summer, we'll see an increase in homelessness, hunger, and desperation as many people lose the only means that they have to support themselves. Dalton McGuinty, when he ran for premier, told us to choose change. But it's become increasingly evident that McGuinty is no different than Mike Harris. He solidified the cuts that Harris implemented, and now he's put in place the most devastating cut to social services in 15 years. The economic crisis has also created room for new attacks on workers. Workers have been forced to take concessions, even in sectors that have high profits. When workers make acts of solidarity with other workers or the communities that they work in, workers like Gaetan Haru, they are penalized, relocated, or fired. These attacks are exacerbated by the G20 meetings in Toronto this summer. We'll see an influx of resources being fueled to policing and security. The desperately needed funds will be used to target homeless people rather than provide food and shelter. As attacks on poor people and marginalized people are intensified, we come together to talk about what's going on in our communities, but more specifically, to ask how we can mobilize to defend ourselves. What role do social agencies play in this struggle, and what responsibility do they have to demand and organize for social justice? And how do we learn from and draw on the strengths of past struggles? Tonight we have an impressive, as you can see, quite large group of panelists to begin this conversation. Our first speaker is Bart Kosiat. He's been doing street-level organizing with low-income tenants, roomers, and the homeless since 1980, and has worked at Parkdale Community Legal Services since 1984. In the 80s, he played a strategic role in the organizing of a successful tenant campaign against Tabco, a Toronto landlord converting apartments to hotels. In the 90s, he helped organize helped tenants organize several successful and prominent rent strikes in Parkdale. And he was active with the organizing of Toronto Street People's Association for the Homeless. He is currently busy helping Parkdale's tenants of Metcap Living, controlled by the Transitional LAD Corporation, organize against the many problems in their homes. He has also been active with the Parkdale Tenants Association's Golden Cockroach campaigns against slumlords and against the City of Toronto's indifference to the deterioration of apartments into slums. So please welcome Bart Kosiat.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction, Nadine. The risk of going first is that you may miss the ball altogether, so I'm just going to throw out a few ideas, and I don't know if it really hits the mark. But one thing I'm going to ask somebody, maybe AJ, is I have about 8 minutes, so can you sort of wave or scream or whatever, because I tend to ramble on for hours, and that could become a problem. Let me start by saying, just before I left the house, I picked up messages in my office at Parkdale Legal Services, and there was a message from somebody from the media saying, I've been referred to you to see what you know about that they're closing legal clinics in rural Ontario. I don't know anything about that, but I know there's a lot of rumors swirling around, and there's definitely cuts in the legal aid system, including clinics, and that's going to come down the tube. But it's just symptomatic of what's happening, and I'll return to that in a minute, hopefully. But first, let me talk about some of the stuff that that has been successful, and they're usually sort of individual struggles about specific issues. One example in the 80s, and I'll only mention three because there's not enough time, but for instance, in the 80s, there was a landlord by the name of Tabco called Toronto Apartment Buildings Companies Limited. And they decided to get away from rent control. They had, I think, about 10 buildings in the Toronto area. They decided these are not apartment buildings, they're hotels. And so we're renting hotel suites. We put a few sticks of furniture in each unit, and we charge whatever the market can bear. And in the 80s, there was a real crisis. A lot of people were coming in to Toronto for work. So these people in the 80s were forced to pay on a daily basis what amounts to a rent of $1,000 for a one-bedroom apartment, which was outrageous, but, you know, people didn't have anywhere else to go. Not to add harm, you know, to add insult to injury, there were many legal cases that the legal clinics, some of them won against Tabco, and they got fined. But they actually went to the government, and they started talking about legalizing their hotel units. So at that time, When we heard about that, we decided to take some action. We went to the tenants. We told them what the legal rents were in their apartments, which is about half what they were paying. And in the end, we ended up going to the Minister of Housing, invading her office with the media in tow. And although she had been having low-level informal talks through the lawyers with TAPCO, she goes, "Oh my goodness, that's terrible. I'm going to do something about that." And the fact is, at that point, TAPCO lost the battle. I mean, I'm just trying to summarize this because it's a long history. Let me give you another example is what we now call the Parkdale Rebellion. Now we're talking about the 90s. There was a move afoot by City Hall in South Parkdale. There was a move afoot in South Parkdale by the City Hall, by the planning department and the politicians, to have no more cheap apartments. And by that I mean rooming houses, even good quality rooming houses, any kind of apartment south of Queen Street. In other words, there was a social cleansing experiment going on. We formed an alliance, a coalition, if you like, the Parkdale Tenant Association, OCAP, a few other organizations, and began to raise hell, and we managed to defeat that proposed bylaw that would have permitted that. So that was the media called that the Parkdale Rebellion, and actually in I Magazine there was a picture on the front page where the masses were stringing up David Miller, who was then the counselor for Parkdale, and Chris Gordon Kuczynski, the other counselor at that time, yet, so they were stringing them up. So that's why we call it now the Parkdale Rebellion. So that was successful. The third thing, we're now sort of in the new century, is the Golden Cockroach campaign that the Parkdale Tenant Association did. This is basically, City Hall wasn't doing anything about bad apartments. We figured the very least we could do, even though the rents were high, is start zeroing in on slum landlords. And what we did is we rated the buildings of the worst buildings of the worst landlords, and then we nominated the worst ones as the nominees for the Golden Cockroach. We even sent a press release to Hollywood because we sort of tried to, and it had some success. The media loved it. I'm not saying that I like particularly the media, but this was, we sort of hit the jackpot there. But ultimately, the campaign was, so we did get some buildings cleaned up, but the campaign was to get City Hall, the City of Toronto, to license landlords and to license buildings. I mean, that was the big thing. And that they were going to do, and they chickened out. They weaseled out. So we presented them with the golden weasel. First the golden rent, the golden cockroach, and the golden weasel. But it was fairly successful. So these are sort of success stories, and I sort of draw a couple of conclusions from that. One is, you got to get the people involved who are most affected by what's going on. So in the case of TAPCO, it was tenants. In all these cases, obviously, it is tenants. But you can't just go out as a sort of an activist and say, I represent thousands of tenants, and my name is Bart Kojat, and blah, blah, blah. And then who are you connecting with? They know right away. So you've got to have a support from the people. And they have to do, ultimately, a lot of the work. So that's...
I need
that's,
you. You need that, me.
Exactly. So that's really important. The other thing is that this stuff, when you do this, you do it with an agency, and that's why I want to get into, oops, 1 minute. I want to get into this at the last minute. That you do this quite often, not because of the agency you work for and who's paying you, but in spite of the agency. Quite often, you get resistance. And that gets us maybe into the discussion, what are these agencies, what is the role of these agencies? Because not only are they getting underfunded, but also a lot of the management is copping out because they're too worried about their own jobs. And I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Bart. Our next speaker is Irene Reiner. She has lived and worked in the East downtown neighborhood of Toronto for the last 14 years. During that time, she has worked with homeless and marginalized individuals, and Irene organizes and works under the premise that an injustice to one is an injustice to all.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Irene Reiner. I'm here today because I fully stand in support of Gaetan having moved back to street health location with the ID clinic. Before I actually get into what I really want to say, I just want to talk a little bit about the Gaetan that I know and work with. I remember, and I think I've said this before, but it's something that reminds me of Gaetan and the true soldier and champion he is to homeless people and the causes that he fights for them. I remember when, as a new immigrant here, when I first got my landed paper and was told that I can now legally work, that the one of my first interviews was with Gaetan at Central Neighborhood House. And Gaetan is the reason that I have an opportunity to be doing the kind of work that I am doing today with homeless and marginalized people. I remember also that on the first day of my job, I could never forget that. Gaetan, I'm sure you don't remember that, but I do. It was my first day on the job, and I wanted to really impress my coworkers and also my boss. And I came in all dressed up, and it was in the drop-in. We were working with homeless people, and we did our shift change, and right after the shift change, Gaetan pulled me aside. And he said, you know, Irene, you got to recognize the people that you're working with. One of the things I'm going to say to you is that I appreciate you dressing appropriately, because when someone walks into the drop-in center, they have to know who the staff are from the users, but you're just a little bit too overdressed for the work. So I've taken that, Gaetan, and honestly, it was the biggest thing, because dressing up wasn't something that I did quite often, and that really brought me back down to reality. But I'm going to go into my discussion now and just talk a little bit more about Gaetan, what I know about him, the important work that he does, and the people who he does the work for. Again, I said I've known him for 14 years. I know him from Central Neighborhood House when we had a drop-in. That's where I first started. I remember way back when I started, the drop-in was located on Parliament, and that was due to some renovations that were being done at 349 Street site where the drop-in used to be in the gym. After the renovations were done, the drop-in was supposed to move back like many of the programs. That wasn't the case. There are people in the neighborhood, like Tedra and those groups that used to be around, decided that they were going to take action and just not wanting the homeless people back into their backyard or in their front door. And Gaetan being Gaetan, decided that CNH has a role to play. CNH serves the community, they serve people that are marginalized, people that are homeless, and that CNH should take a stand in standing up and not just succumbing to the neighbors or the community members that live in the East Downtown area. There was a lot of discussions around whether the drop-in should come back to CNH or not. In the end, it was a decision that it wasn't supposed to come back. Gaetan decided that if the drop-in wasn't going to come back to CNH, that there was no way that he was going to work for an organization or support an organization that wouldn't stand up and fight for the people that it so chooses to or claim to be fighting for. And as a result of that, he organized us as workers and told us that we were going to march. And we were going to march right into the neighborhood where those people live who didn't want the drop-in back. I think it was a day or two before we actually were supposed to do the march. Our staff all got letters from the ED saying that if we took part in that march, that we wouldn't have a job. Gaetan, I'm not sure what he did, but he spoke to some lawyers, got some legal advice, and was able to inform us that if we were to take part in that, that we wouldn't lose our jobs, and that if that happened, that he would ensure that we would get it back. And so we march along the street. In the end, there was no success. The dropping never came back, and Gaetan himself decided not to return back to CNH as a result. It is very important for me today to stand here in support with Gaetan to defend the need for public services in the East Downtown neighborhood. One such service is the ID clinic. During the years that I've lived in the neighborhood, I have noticed how my community is changing. Such changes are the gentrification of public services and housing are just to name a few. I've seen many of our laneways close up. We no longer have access to them. I've seen our bus shelters being taken off the street. We can no longer stay in a shelter out of rain, out of the snow, for waiting for the bus. I've seen neighborhood restaurants that were really cheap and affordable just disappear and are no longer there. So people who are poor or marginalized and who can't afford expensive meals no longer have restaurants that serve meals that are reasonable price. I've also seen new condos on every block, every corner, just popping up. Everywhere you go, it's condos, condos. But when it comes to the services, they're slowly disappearing or gone. I've seen shelters, I've seen drop-in centers, the loss of bed, and the number of people that go without a place to sleep. The numbers are incredibly high. Based on the different changes that I've seen in my neighborhood in terms of the shelters disappearing, in terms of restaurants that are affordable, in terms of the shelters, I am wondering if this is also part of the gentrification, if street health and neighborhood link services are also joining that fight or in that. I am sure that Gaetan was not hired at the ID clinic position because he was loved and well-dressed. I believe he was hired because he knew the issues and were willing to stand up and challenge and take on the fight for people that were homeless or marginalized. He has spent many years advocating on behalf of the poor, whether it was through deputations at City Hall, organizing rallies, and the role that he's played with OCAP in converging on the many abandoned buildings to raise awareness about the lack of affordable housing and to hold those in positions accountable. By removing the ID clinic from the Dundas and Sherburn area, simply because Gaetan supported his co-workers at Street Health is just wrong. Not only it is wrong, but it's also a personal attack on the poor, who has so far done nothing. Organizations such as Street Health and Neighborhood Link that has missions to help the poor and marginalized, your actions have demonstrated the opposite. When I read the history of Street Health, how it was organized and who organized it, it begs me to ask the question, is Street Health no longer in the business of standing up, advocating and challenging for the right of the poor and the homeless? I am therefore calling on Laura McCowan, DD of Street Health, and Laura McGowan, the ED of Street Health, and Mary McGowan of Neighborhood Link to reinstate the services at Street Health and to offer the space. Thank you.
Thank you, Irene. Now we're going to ask Stephanie Massey to speak. She moved to Toronto in 2002, and she has worked with poor people and homeless people in downtown Toronto for the last 6 years, specifically in harm reduction and HIV/AIDS health promotion.
Hi, everybody. Not very used to talking with a microphone. So one of the questions when I was asked if I would speak today was like, how will people organize themselves today to fight against poverty and to defend our neighborhoods and services? And I was thinking, well, who are we defending against? And what are we defending against? And It's not like business improvement associations, residents associations, the media, the police, politicians who want to say that nothing exists here already and that this space isn't being used. It's broken down housing and broken down communities. And I think that is just so wrong, because every day it takes courage and determination to do more than just survive. Every day people are working and dealing with what we have and not what we don't have. And it's never enough. And I want to swear when I talk. And when we organize, we are using our knowledge and our experience, the information and relationships the communities have already. And I look around this room and I see so many people who come here with so many gifts. And that's one thing we defend against, the notion that this is a broken down community. And where I work in the downtown West End, that the community is not working. We see a condo bomb going off and so much pressure coming down on communities. And I just am constantly thinking, I work at an agency, and so what is the role of an agency? Now, I always thought Street Health was so unique because it actually was shaped and an invitation of that community. And it wasn't tokenism, it wasn't top-down government saying, okay, well, you can sit on this committee and we might listen to you. But at the same time, lots of agencies are happy when people use their services. You give good feedback, you tell me what you like about the service, tell me what you want to say. And then when people say no, they're not heard. If we can't say no, then our yes has no meaning. People have said no to moving Gaetan out of the downtown east side, and no one is listening. So what does it mean? Is that just Street Health deciding, or other agencies, deciding what each community needs, as opposed to who has a voice in shaping the services? I feel like folks need to have a say in the how, the what, the where's, the when, and the who of what's happening in these communities. I work at an agency, and I feel like community organizations really need to operate as allies and to give space and follow leadership from the community and not just decide what each neighborhood means. We give up a little bit of space, we never get that back. You know, the neighborhood is constantly changing and under pressure, but we give it up and we're not getting those spaces back. You see that with the closed laneways and the loss of public space and the crackdown on policing, and of course, because there's nowhere to go anymore. So I just was thinking about those questions. You know, the second question I was asked was like, what is the role of social agencies in this struggle? Well, I just think I babbled about it. And, you know, we talk about can poor communities learn from past struggles, and I think that we're constantly learning, and we're also not being constrained by past struggles. You know, you're still building on them. There's a rooming house landlord networking committee now that still is not the city. The city is still not doing it. It's a bunch of people who live in rooming houses, a bunch of agency workers, and a bunch of rooming house landlords who are like, let's get together and figure something out. And that's, you know, taking leadership from people who are living in rooming houses, who are fed up. So I feel like we have to keep looking in other cities and see what's happening there as well, and take like account of what's happening in this room. People are bringing so much to the table, and I think as someone who works at an agency, it's part of our job to listen and create space for voices to be heard. I mean, I work mostly with substance users, and the big thing you'll hear in like substance and harm reduction movement and across disabilities is nothing about us without us. And that is exactly what is happening in this community. You know, Street Health has lost that, and you know, that's something we're always trying to get in when we do work with substance users. Okay, I'm good for time. But you know, I just think that we have to maintain that on a constant basis, because we get to define our goals and our plans. We get to decide how we measure where we are at. And I'm not coming with any answers. So I just wanted to make those comments right there. I think I can leave right there.
Thank you, Stephanie. Our next speakers are Farshad Azadian and Solomon Muyuboki. Both are activists whose reputation precedes them. in the Esplanade community in the downtown East Side, and they're organizing around issues of police brutality, housing, and labor issues.
I think if we yell loud enough, I think everyone can hear it. So,
Mike,
you really want the mic, eh?
Okay, well, there we go, okay. So, first of all, I want to give a thank you to the folks at... Yeah, complaining both sides. Okay. So I want to give a thanks to the folks at OCAP here, and Gaetana especially, because of the guidance they've, you know, provided us down organizing in the Esplanade community. And also, you know, a lot of us young activists, you know, we take a lot of experiences and lessons from people who preceded us. But at the same time, there's an important room for debate about how do we go forward in the current economic crisis. Now, if you kind of notice, me and Solomon are kind of just like shifting a bit of notes. We didn't actually expect to speak today. And I guess we're going to go a bit differently from what's been said so far in terms of our own work in the Esplanade community, you know, how we've taken that about, and kind of how we orient ourselves in the current economic crisis. How do we see ourselves organizing working class and poor communities, and where does that struggle lead to? So,
I'm going to talk briefly about our organization, which is the Esplanade Community Group, a bit about our origins and how we got started. We're a young organization. We started doing work about 6 months ago. It started off with me and Farshad and a few others. We got together and realized that we had a bunch of issues in our neighborhoods that weren't being dealt with, right? We had issues. We came up with a six-point program, which, I'll take it back a little bit. We decided we needed to know what the problems were in our neighborhoods. So what we did is we came up with a survey, right? So we went door to door. Each of us got maybe about 10 or so surveys, and we went out and found out what the issues were. We asked about, like, how are your housing conditions, right? A lot of people complained about repairs. A lot of the youth complained about police brutality, right? So we took this and we made a six-point program, right? And it generally, our mandates are around housing, around police brutality, as well as anything I'm missing?
Unions.
Unions, right? We also wanted to improve the jobs within our neighborhoods, right? So from there, we got together and we ran a few workshops. We got some youth groups together. We ended up running a few educationals, right, where we looked at some of the more advanced groups that had been here before our time, right? We looked at the Panthers and how they did them. We showed the movie, I don't know if you guys have seen Panther, which is great, and it shows you how we model ourselves very similarly to them, right? We try to stay very grassrooted. We try to keep our work moving. We try not to stay stagnant and try to take up the issues that we have as they come, right? One of the campaigns we're running right now is a police watch, a cop watch, is what we're working on right now, because within our communities we've had huge issues. As some of you may have picked up, Basics, we wrote an article in there about a youth that got beat up twice
just
in 1 week.
It
was right here. We had forums about 3 or 4 weeks ago. We had a forum in which Kathy Crow came out, Suzanne Wallace also came out. We had about an attendance of about 60 people, and there was a mixed crowd between youth and adults, right? And that's another thing we do. We try not to separate the youth from the adults, right? You try to get them to work together. So I think Farshad's just going to tell you a little bit more about, I guess, our theory and whatnot.
Yeah, just, so first off, just what Solomon's saying, like, with our work, the way we kind of oriented ourselves is, you know, keep it grassroots. What are people facing immediately? What can we take up? You know, what issues can we take up right now here to get people moving? At the same time, we're not just all about practice at the same time. A lot of us, we got to start thinking, okay, where are we going with this? You know what I mean? It's not just, okay, we're going to go observe some cops. Where are we trying to go with this? Okay, we're going to stop a few evictions, but that doesn't deal with the issue that the cops can come into our neighborhood whenever they want, or TCAC runs the housing in our community. So we do take the issue of, you know, education theory very seriously. We try to keep it grounded. So, you know, we study, like, the Black Panthers. You know, we study, you know, the labor movement in Canada. We study the Venezuelan Revolution. Some of us, you know, went down to Venezuela over the last, you know, last year, tried to learn from that struggle there, from, you know, the communist movement in Canada and in the world. Just, you know, in the end, you know, a lot of us activists have been out here doing work. You know, I only have a few years under my belt, but I've had, like, a lot of times where I've just, you know, hit my head against the wall over and over and over again. So, I mean, we got to learn from these things. So we take issue of theory, we try to link it up directly to our practice and where we're going to go from here, especially with this economic crisis. You know, our money has been going out, you know, the big banks, you know, they're cutting our social services left, right, and center. They're attacking us on all fronts. So we need to really, in the end, we got to be thinking where we're going to go with our struggles. You know, I mean, there's an important need for that. So, I mean, although the Esplanade Community Organization is a working class organization, you know, working class and poor residents in our community, it's open to all who, you know, are down with the six-point program, we also take that debate up very seriously into our work. Now, I just want to lead, you know, from there into a talk about, so, I mean, you know, a lot of us in this room are activists, been doing, you know, a lot of us have, you know, socialist, revolutionary ideas, and some of us have, you know, it's a variety of ideas here. But at the same time, how do we take our work up among the people? You know, it's easy enough for me to get, you know, 20, 30, 40, you know, left-wing militants and go do some proper work. At the same time, how do we bring over the mass of working class people with us? You know, how do we, you know, get average people involved in that struggle? Because they'd be facing the issues, but, you know, we got to get that mass participation. In the end, it's, you know, the mass of working class and poor people in Toronto who are going to make that social change, not a group of 30, 40, 50, or even 100 of us. And so that's an important question of how we orient. We approach step by step. We try to always involve people in the struggles, and that's kind of how our successes have happened in the Esplanade community, where, you know, parents or average youth are, you know, maybe taking part in the cop wash program, maybe just dropping off leaflets, you know what I mean, coming out to forums discussing these issues. One of the important things, you know, in those discussions we've had in the Esplanade community group is, how do we orient ourselves to other working class organizations? One of the important things for us is, you know, the labor movement, the union movement. You know, although many people in our community may not be unionized, you know, how do we build this, you know, the power of labor in our community? We're taking out a Sobeys union drive in our community, but also, you know, linking ourselves with the broader union movement. You know, Kelly O'Sullivan from QP4308 has been a big supporter. You know, how do we link up with the United Food and Commercial Workers Union? How do we carry that work up? And also orient ourselves around the NDP. Now, some people here might be like, oh, NDP, you know, there's all these issues. And, you know, I'll be there with you. You know, I've had my issues with the NDP. You know, a lot of us look at it as like, oh, where's that fighting spirit? You know, that, you know, might have been there in the past. But the way we see it is NDP is an organization built by us working class people. And it's our job to struggle within those organizations, you know, to bring a proper militant orientation there. You know, Kathy Crowe's campaign was, to us, you know, an important example of that, where you had, you know, a more left-wing push in the NDP. Talk about, you know, concrete grassroots issues. We had 20 youth out there going door to door because, you know, they feel that stuff. You know, in our community, you know, we haven't seen that kind of active kind of grassroots orientation to the NDP. That's something that we need to struggle for. So, you know, we give, you know, mad respect to Kathy Crowe for that. So, I mean, like, for us, I think the important thing is when we're talking about organizing poor communities, we're not trying to isolate ourselves in, say, one neighborhood. We're trying to link up with the broader working class movement and struggling alongside the working class organizations. Most people, they see, you know, I might say I'm a communist here today, but, you know, go to average person, they ain't going to relate to that. Oh, you know, there's 10, 15, 100, 200 of you in Toronto. You know, I ain't going to deal with my bread and butter issues. So you got, for us, the important thing is to struggle in your, you know, in the traditional organizations of working class people, and to advance that struggle. So that's something that, like, you know, we're debating constantly in our organization. But I think that's an important message because, like, I mean, I've done, you know, the opposite way. You know, I've done what I consider to be ultra left work. You know, we did a sit-in at the University of Toronto. We all got arrested for that stuff. And, you know, it's very easy for activists to isolate themselves from the community. That's, I think, my key point. And so we need to bring average people alongside and advance them with us. That's the only way we're going to win this thing. So, yeah. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Brian Dubourdieu. He is a community member in the downtown East End and has been homeless for the past 20 years. Brian?
Hi, folks. My name is Brian. And very thank you to the guys from the Esplanade, because you know what? We got to unite. I'm from Norfolk Queen Street. I'm from the North Park. I'm from the shelters. I'm from there. I've lived 20 years in there. And you know what? This is exactly what he said. We got to unite. We have to friggin' figure out a way to communicate with each other. We have to find a way to friggin' unite on all fronts. Not just one, not one common cause, but all causes. We have to cross all bridges. I met some friends. We formed an organization called Street Health. And it was a great organization run by homeless people. It was run and commanded by Street Health. There was no paid staff at the time. There was a dive-in beggar, volunteer nurse. But it graduated. It graduated to an organization. It morphed into a bigger organization. And it was still a fraction. This organization was the greatest organization. It swung bigger than it ever was. Like, we only had 20 staff. By the time of 1995, we had 20 staff. But you know what? We're writing reports. They're going nationwide. We were... Not how many hamburgers we served or how many people we served. We were the model of what you should do for homeless people. That's what we were. This organization was great. I sat on that board for 6 years. And you know what? I enjoyed my 6 years on it. But the last year, I didn't enjoy it because I saw it decline. I saw them systematically take homeless people off the board. I seen them invest money in friggin' goddamn stock markets. Instead of giving guys socks, they're investing in stock markets. You know, their fucking money is going in stock markets. How the fuck can they do that? You know, that's ridiculous. They lost a bunch of money. So you know what? No socks for the homeless. They lost too much money in stock markets. But you know what? They filled. I've seen positions go a year without being filled just to fucking pay up accounts. That's ridiculous. This is not the same Street Health that I knew. I knew a Street Health that swung above its weight and people advocated. And anyone that advocates now for Street Health, tries to help out the homeless, is silenced. They're cut off. That's what disgusts me about this unit. And I will not fucking deal with that unit. That's why I want to see Street Health go down. Thank you very much.